Hello and welcome to Nationwide Discussion Hour on Radio Miraya. My name is Lucy Kiden. Today we hear from panelists that were part of a webinar on the state of peace in South Sudan and the implementation of the 2018 peace agreement. The forum, held in Washington, U.S. yesterday, was organized and hosted by the University of Notre Dame School of Global Affairs and the mediation program of the Kroc Institute for International Peace Studies in partnership with IGAD and Swiss Peace. In attendance were representatives from IGAD and Swiss Peace. Part of the discussion at the webinar identifies lessons and recommendations intended to strengthen future peacemaking by IGAD. The main focus will be the revitalized peace agreement signed by the conflict parties in 2018. The five panelists at the webinar are Ahmed Hersi, Senior Advisor to the IGAD Special Envoy for South Sudan, Dr. David Lantz, Co-Head of the Swiss Peace Mediation Program, Emily Koiti, the Youth Representative of the Reconstituted Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission, and Madhav Joshi, Associate Director of the Peace Accords Matrix, and Ambassador Henna Tata, Special Representative of the UN Secretary General to the African Union. She's also one of the co-facilitators of the 2018 peace agreement. The webinar is moderated by Larry Nathan, Director of the Kroc Mediation Program, and hosted at the University of Notre Dame. The first speaker, Ahmed Hersi, Senior Advisor to the IGAD Special Envoy for South Sudan, presents the IGAD's perspective on progress and challenges in the peace process.
This time, we are sticking with this agreement of September 2018, which has made an encouraging progress so far. The ceasefire, basically as we speak now, is the backbone of the agreement, and we are in the longest truce since 2013 in terms of security. There's no active hostilities going on. There are quite a number of pre-transitional period institutions and mechanisms that are in place. I can safely say that there's a number of achievements there are two issues that are stumbling blockwise. One was the transition security arrangement, which is actually going very slow. And the other one was the number of states, which we encourage the parties to agree to. So I think the two major concessions were traded off. I will go to the challenges that surround the agreement as we move around. There is a general sense of pervading, lack of political will by all the parties to implement the agreement in the letter and spirit. And this actually stalls the implementation process. And takes it into the time of the pre-transitional, the transitional period for 6 months. There are also competing interests that leads to some of the parties to understand or interpret the agreement in a different ways. And IGAD has to be called upon to mediate those two in order to bring people to the table. But there are these interests that are coming emanating from the parties in the interpretation of the law. There's a trust deficit, we can say, among the parties themselves, and this is a result of many years of fighting. And this is where, again, IGAD is trying to propose a series of leadership, which all the parties in the Artigono, series of leadership retreats. I think that program was sort of delayed or pushed back by the advent of COVID in March, but we have those line up to at least deal with the issue of trust. Funding is another challenge, and a recurring challenge. Peace is a very expensive undertaking. There's always a shortage of fund, and basically also there's an overall donor fatigue in terms of South Sudan, because the country has been going on through a conflict process since 2013 to date. So there's a pervading sort of a donor fatigue when it comes to South Sudan programming. They also, even within a party or sort of an alliance like SSO, Sudan Salvation Opposition Alliance, there are many alliances which actually keeps shifting. There are also schism or problems within them when it comes to taking up positions that are offered by the current government. So there's always a split. Egad comes in to at least to seal that crack, but it hasn't become a major crack yet, but that's also within the parties that have signed to the agreement as a one entity also seem to either mutate or split off due to the internal politics now in terms of jockeying for position and who will take which position in government. Basically, one observation is that the agreement, and basically the parties and the personnel around the South Sudan government, is a bit elitist, and there's a little public participation or public knowledge. We've made attempts so that I think the agreement is popularized through Radio Sudan, South Sudan, but there's a little public participation. That's one thing. There are, as we have said, security threats from the non-signatories, an ever-present danger. There's an intercommunal clashes in South Sudan. People are very much heavily armed society, both in the rural area. And it's tribals who hold arms who are, there's a thin line define what is an armed group and what is a tribe. So they're all armed and sometimes can all be a grouping. So that's also the issues of arms, the issues of gun culture, and the issues of the lack of ungoverned space is also one particular problem. I've mentioned about the high defections in terms of armed personnel. I would like to mention that currently the country is undergoing a problem, the humanitarian situation. There's a lot of floods since last year, the beginning of this year. Locust has been another problem, causing a problem to farmers. And we also have the new thing called COVID. One of the challenges also, there's a lot of international actors very much involved in the peacemaking in South Sudan, multiple actors. So sometimes they come with a different perspective and various interests. I think with that, I think I will leave it for some of the colleagues to mention a bit. Thank you very much, Chair.
Ahmed, thank you. That was a fantastic synopsis of the current situation, both the progress and the challenges. You know, we focus at events like this and more broadly in the peace world, we tend to focus on the peacemakers, the mediators, their partners, the donors, etc. But I would simply emphasize your point about the political will of the parties. At the end of the day, whether there is peace or not, whether the peace agreement is implemented or not, depends not on the third parties, it depends on the conflict parties. And their political will is ultimately the most important factor of all. So thank you for that. I hand over to David Lantz.
Thank you, Laurie. So in my intervention, I will focus on the initial period of the peace process. So from December 2013, when violence broke out in Juba, to August 2015, when the initial peace agreement was signed. And I believe this initial period is important to understand the current peace process. And it's also the period which is covered by the review of lessons learned, which you, Laurie, have mentioned in the introduction. And it is that review, that study of lessons learned, which I would like to focus on in my presentation. So about the study. The aim of the study was quite straightforward. It was to examine the IGAD-led mediation in South Sudan and draw lessons from it in the hope of informing future mediation engagements of IGAD or of other mediation entities. The final report, it contains 44 lessons across 11 themes. I obviously won't be able to cover everything, so I invite you to read the report. As a teaser, I will elaborate now on three particular lessons which arise from IGAD's mediation effort in South Sudan from 2013 to 2015. The first lesson I want to focus on pertains to the response to violent conflict in South Sudan. IGAD was very quick to react when violence broke out in Juba on 15th of December 2013. Within only 4 days, he got dispatched a high-level ministerial delegation. Within 2 weeks, he got heads of states, held an extraordinary summit, mandated the mediation process, and appointed special envoys of high stature to lead it. And within 3 weeks of violence erupting, the IGAD-led peace talks started. And that speed, the speed of IGAD's reaction, is quite significant, and it probably helped to contain some of the escalating violence, even if, as we all know, it didn't stop the violence per se. However, many experts that we spoke to, including from within IGAD, said that the writing was on the wall before December 2013, that the power struggles between SPLM leaders, which bubbled up after President Kiir dissolved his cabinet in July, were likely to lead to violence. And even so, there wasn't a sufficiently robust diplomatic push to prevent that scenario, neither from IGAD nor from other entities. And the lesson, therefore, is that while early action and political leadership in the face of violence is important, diplomacy and dialogue should be used before violence escalates in a preventative logic. That's the first lesson. The second lesson I want to focus on pertains to the lead mediators. As you know, the IGAD heads of states in December 2013 appointed three envoys. Dr. Hersey before mentioned their names. These envoys were political heavyweights with intimate knowledge of South Sudan and also with personal relationships with the parties. And this proved to be quite useful. In addition, having three envoys from frontline countries, Ethiopia, Kenya, and Sudan, helped to anchor the process in the region. It provided leverage and it secured buy-in from the region. However, there were downsides. Having three envoys posed different coordination problems. It also imported into the mediation team some of the political divisions in the region vis-a-vis South Sudan. It made it more difficult for the mediation to have a unified, cohesive approach. And the lesson arising from this is that appointing a single envoy might be the better approach. Alternatively, when multiple envoys are appointed, a clear lead should be designated and a division of labor spelled out in the mandate. Third and final lesson concerning the role of external actors. The peace talks in 2013 to 2015 were driven by external actors putting pressure on the parties. This kind of leverage has proved necessary in the peace process in South Sudan. And indeed, the peace agreement in August 2015 was reached because there was strong pressure from the region and also from the United States, which made it clear that if there weren't an agreement, it would impose sanctions against senior leaders and push through an arms embargo. This kind of pressure secured the conclusion of the agreement, but there was a price to pay. The leverage meant that the parties signed the agreement not because they were convinced that a settlement was in their interest, but because they caved to external pressure. And this was especially true for Salva Kiir and his government. Indeed, the government in Juba perceived the agreement as being imposed, and in a sense it was. The text of the agreement was primarily drafted by the mediation team, and the process was quite rushed, especially in the final weeks. This meant that the parties had limited ownership and few incentives to implement the agreement. Not surprisingly, when international attention shifted elsewhere and pressure dissipated, the parties reneged on some of their commitments. And this eventually led to the collapse of the 2015 agreement, as you all know quite well. And so the lesson that derives from this is that while external engagement is necessary, it must not be the only engine of process. For mediation to succeed, the ownership of the parties, the relationship between them, in particular its leaders, and the genuine consent of the parties are necessary or even indispensable. So just in conclusion, let me just again say that what I spoke about now focuses on the period from 2013 to 2015. Perhaps in the discussion we have time to explore to what extent IGAD has incorporated some of these lessons into its current efforts. And at the very end, let me just say that from a mediation perspective, these kinds of transparent lessons learned generating exercising, basically using the past to inform the future, are quite valuable, and I for one hope that other mediation organizations would follow IGAD's example. With this, thank you for your attention, and back to you, Lori.
David, thank you very much for that. Your last point about ownership is obviously critical. It ties with Ahmed's point about the political will of the parties and the need for reconciliation between the parties, because at the end of the day, their cooperation is required for the implementation of the agreement and for peace, stability, and sound governance. Ahmed also raised difficulties in relation to the elite nature of the process and the absence of adequate involvement by civil society. This has been a contentious issue throughout the process, despite the insistence by the IGAD summit that civil society be included in the peace process. It's therefore fitting that we turn now to Emily, a civil society representative in the Monitoring and Evaluation Commission, to give her perspectives. Emily, over to you.
Thank you very much, Laurie. It's a privilege to be part of this conversation with distinguished panelists, as you mentioned them in the lineup. I want to start by saying that this perspective that I'm sharing in this platform is not the official position of the civil society fraternity. It's a perspective based on my individual observations as a member of the civil society. We have not yet sat as civil society to come up with an official assessment, the latest official assessment of where things stand. But this is where things stand as I see them. Are we locked in crisis? I mean, are we locked in a lack of progress? I would say we are locked in a stagnated, it's not even progress. We've stagnated at this time. The reasons are there. Some have been mentioned by the preceding speakers. But who is responsible? It's mostly the parties, the South Sudanese parties, but also I must say IGAD as a mediator is responsible here. And I'll go on to say that although we started off at the end of 2018 after signing the peace agreement, with a very good momentum, commendable at the time. The then chairperson of the Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission set us at a pace, and he made an outline of 12 key things that had to be implemented immediately just to set us on a good pace. And that included parties, stakeholders, and everybody else nominating representatives to mechanisms of the peace agreement, commitments to uphold the ceasefire, and a number of many other things as many of us might be aware of. But over time we've seen progress slow down, become sluggish, and that has warranted two extensions of the pre-transition period, as we saw. And then a late formation of the RT GONU, or the Transitional Government of National Unity, in its revitalized form, which is also partially formed. At the national level, we only have the executive formed, that is the presidency and the council of ministers. And then at the state level, we have a partially formed executive too, and with only 9 governors appointed out of 10, no ministers appointed. There is a vacuum at that level with all the prevailing issues at the state level. And We've seen also a number of bad signs, like the tendency for one particular party to make appointments without the consultation of others, that is post formation of Artigon. We've also seen alteration of things that have been agreed on, for example, the National Constitution Amendment. The Constitution Amendment Bill has been amended by one party without, yet they had sat already in the NCSC, that is the National Constitution Amendment Committee, to agree on the position which had to be final, and all what was required was for the parliament to then incorporate that into the transitional constitution of the Republic of South Sudan. And in addition to that, the president has been required by IGAD, by stakeholders, and by even the RGMX Secretariat to dissolve parliament according to procedure. The parliament that is said to be existent is an illegitimate assembly, at least according to some of us, most of us in the civil society. And the failure to dissolve that, and despite a number of calls from IGAD. IGAD has repeatedly said dissolve parliament, and then the president or the presidency is not able to yield to that call. That is problematic. It shows that the mediator is not being listened to. And on judicial reforms, we are talking transitional justice. On that front, we've only had conversations that have started with the AU. We also have conversations that have started on Chapter 6, just about organizing the workshop by RGMEC for the stakeholders, just bits and bits of certain aspects of the chapter. And on the security front, yes, largely we have a ceasefire that is holding. If I am to compare the period of the agreement, the first agreement of 2015 to the current one, we have a largely holding ceasefire. Yes, there are holdout groups that have not been able to be part of the implementation, but the combat and the engagement in conflict has been restricted to just certain places, although there is intercommunal violence in other places that remains to be addressed. And then also the attempt, the good thing is that as Ahmed mentioned, that there has been the ROM process that is making attempts to bring them on board. Where that can go, we are yet to see. And parties are still also adamant, and especially the party that is seen to be the heavyweight, that is the former incumbent Tigonu, is not able to have its forces. I say its forces because until today we do not have a national unified army constituted by all the integrated forces, and we are lagging behind on that. So until today they've not been able to vacate at least 18 civilian facilities. That is dangerous when it comes to building confidence of civilians who want to see those places vacated so that then they can return from the internally displaced camps and the refugee camps and the rest of us to feel a sense of respite at the end of the day. And then the military defections, of course, that have been mentioned. And just yesterday, there was a JMEC plenary and that was condemned, but we have seen that over time, the tendency to continue recruiting from each other and destabilizing each other when it comes to the military power that each has to wield. Although when it comes to when they have to agree on their power sharing ratios, we have observed, I have observed the tendency to exercise a spirit of collegiality. That is often when we see it, although still there, we see inconclusive agreement on, for example, the allocation of state portfolios until today. That is very dangerous because you still have a vacuum at that level, the state. You have two other arms of government that are not formed. The National Assembly is not formed, and somehow they have agreed to go ahead and first focus on formation of state governments before formation of the Transitional National Legislative Assembly, which in itself is a violation of the agreement. If they have agreed to amend in the spirit of collegiality, we expected to see that amendment to be in tandem with the provisions of the agreement, that is according to Article 8.4, which requires that any amendment must be done by certain entities, and that includes RGMEC. We've also seen the humanitarian situation get worse, of course, exacerbated by COVID-19 pandemic and the floods over time. And COVID has been used as an excuse. The second quarter of this year, and now this third quarter of 2020, we have seen very little progress seen with mechanisms unable to convene their board meetings. And it's only yesterday from March that RGMEC was able to have a plenary. And that is a very important mechanism for decision making and advising on how we can progress. And so, but why are we here? It's a number of reasons that have been given, and I'll just add to what Ahmed and David have mentioned. The parties have failed to afford the process the seriousness it deserves, and they are still struggling to overcome the tendency to look for excuses. And that is something that we have seen not just in these two peace agreements, but even passed in the CPA pre-independence. Of course, number two, there are funding constraints. That is not just with the parties not being able to commit resources. I can't expect all parties, but the ones that have been in charge of our resources throughout the conflict, that is the incumbent Tigono, has not been able to provide the adequate resources until to date. And then civil society is also having constraints in terms of funding, attributable to the donor fatigability that has been mentioned by Ahmed. And we still can't, the previous agreement collapsed and warranted revitalization because of lack of unreserved good faith on the part of parties. We continue to see that when coalitions are having internal problems and then they accuse another party of having infiltrated them to disorganize them. When we see the defections, the military defections, that is a lack of good faith on the part of those parties. And misplaced priorities that are not inspiring the commitment of partners. Partners from the beginning say that there must be commitment from the parties, and that is the condition they are giving for them to offer support. That has not been forthcoming from our observation. And then, but why did I say IGAD from the beginning? Until to date, IGAD has not been able, the heads of state and with the Council of Ministers, those bodies have not been able to appoint a substantive chairperson of the reconstituted Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission. And we saw a change of guard in terms of the interim chairperson, called interim, but supposed to be the deputy chairperson. We were very, the drafters of the initial agreement, we are very deliberate in thinking that there has to be a particular individual who fits that status to be a chairperson of RGMEC, because there's something it does to the agreement. And until today, it's not done. But what does that then mean? It's a stark reminder to parties that the mediator is also failing and does not have the adequate moral capital to be calling out parties when they are failing to implement their part. And then finally, the pandemic is here. It has been used as an excuse. It's people failing to be versatile and not adapting to mechanisms like what we are using right now to convene meetings, to have dialogue, to take the conversation forward. Although I must say there's an exception. The National Constitution Amendment Committee has adapted and has been able to continue with its work by also convening conversations among its within its membership using some platforms, virtual platforms, and that is commendable. We cannot afford to continue using this pandemic as an excuse for not moving forward. The pandemic is here. It will go, there will be another pandemic and life has to go on. People must be versatile and we should be seen to be making progress. I'll leave it at that. Back to you, Laurie. Thank you very much.
Emily, thank you. Asante sana. There's been a common theme from our speakers so far with respect to implementation, and they are all David Lance, Ahmed, and now Emily, underlining that we should not view the political process as peace negotiations, and thereafter the implementation process as a purely technical exercise. The implementation process is political and reflects the power struggles of the parties. and may be afflicted not only by technical difficulties, but by a host of political difficulties. So with that, it's a great way of introducing my colleague Madhav Joshi, who will talk about implementation. Madhav, in the Peace Accords Matrix at CROC, are amongst the international experts on Peace Accord implementation. Madhav, over to you.
Thank you, Laurie. We talked about the pre-transition period that was extended a couple of times. Within pre-transition, there are 69 specific tasks that was laid out, and all parties agreed to those tasks. Within 69 tasks, there are 7 specific tasks that relates to the training and deployment of the necessary unified forces, and those tasks, you know, have not been done. It is a pre-transition period, you know, tasks that are still not completed, and we are already in the transition period here. We already have, you know, into the 8 months of the transition period. Coming to the transition period here, you know, we have 186 specific tasks within the transition period. This transition period is for the next 36 months. And we are already, you know, we only have 28 months left. By looking what's going on from the reports produced by RJMAC, there are only 2 specific tasks that were completed. And it relates to the formation of the national unity government, and then the, you know, to some extent, appointment of the governors in the state, at the state level. There were 69 specific tasks that were supposed to be initiated or implemented by last June, and they already missed the deadline. What could be the possible causes for a slow implementation here? I'm from a peace process background. I do a lot of, you know, study on the factors that contribute to successful implementation and things like that. So my field of study, my research and field of history suggests 2 possible explanations for this one. One is obviously the commitment problem, the lack of political will that we already talked about. When the parties negotiate these accords, you know, I mean, all accords, they oftentimes negotiate under tremendous international pressure and under tremendous pressure of ongoing violence. And once the peace agreement is in place, they have incentive to renounce the commitment after that. The second reason is, we alluded to this to some extent, relates to technical and resource capacity here. Signatories, you know, they do not know what they are negotiating when they are negotiating the peace accord. And they are not also very realistic in terms of whether the reforms that they are negotiating can actually be implemented under a certain deadline. In case of South Sudan, you know, it's a really interesting, I think it's a unique case. It has both problems. It has commitment problems, it has resource problems, it has, you know, technical capacity problems to implement what is being negotiated and put in the revitalized peace agreement. And we also talk about the COVID crisis that is obviously, you know, causing some harm here in terms of the work of the monitoring of ceasefire violations and things like that. But as it was said, you know, it should not be the cover up for the lack of political will of the parties here. There are reports coming from South Sudan that there are no regular cabinet meetings. And also, you know, we all know that the South Sudan is financially broke at this stage. You know, it does not have any foreign reserve. You know, the financial capacity is not there. So now I move to my third point that I'm trying to make here, is the need for continued mediation support. South Sudan, I think, is the perfect example. There is a lack of political will among political actors, and then lack of resources and capacity here. So it is a perfect example where mediators need to remain engaged with the process to save the process. It's a hard-fought peace agreement, and there is no alternative to implementing the peace agreement. So oftentimes, what we assume, you know, as a practitioner, as a researcher, is that the role of the mediators end once the peace agreement is in place. But actually, that's not the case. There is more for the mediators during the implementation process. And I list them here, a few that I identified, and we can pick up during our conversation. The first one is the implementation is simply the another bargaining. You know, when you implement something, you identify the winners and the losers, and there is always bargaining among the parties. And it becomes delicate, especially during the implementation process, because the process is now open and you are including more stakeholders at the national level and at the subnational level. So the bargaining is even more complex during the implementation process. And there is a huge role for the mediators to play. The second possible reason is the timeline. As I was saying, in any peace process, it's not only the problem in South Sudan, they have never met the timeline. It is very frustrating, as a researcher and as a practitioner, but obviously it is also related to the capacity and then the resource they have. And then the third point that I would like to make here is the signatories, they have a very different readings of the peace accord. Sometimes ambiguities are good during the negotiation process, but when it comes to implementation, the same ambiguity can cause implementation impasse. And that's why, if we have the institutional knowledge of the mediators coming from the negotiation process, during the implementation process, that will tremendously help the parties to overcome that ambiguity during the implementation process. The next point that I would like to make here is about the sequencing preferences of, we see this in full place in South Sudan. From the very beginning, the incumbent government wanting to go for the unity government without implementing the necessary unified forces and then the state boundaries. So they have a very different implementation sequencing preference than the other signatories. Then how you reconcile those preferences, there is a huge role for the mediators. South Sudan, everything is transitional in South Sudan. They have the transitional constitution and they have to write the final constitution. Constitution writing process itself can be very contentious. In Nepal, it took 10 years and we have a deadline of, next 28 months in South Sudan. And after that, there will be a post-conflict election that will then institutionalize all the reforms, right? The election can be really contentious, especially given what's going on in South Sudan. So there is a risk of violence before election, there is a risk of violence after election. So there is a lot that for the mediators, and I'm not saying that, obviously, it's a very difficult process, but it is not that we cannot contribute to the success of this process. This is a very timely debate, I look forward for picking up some of the things during the conversation here. Thanks, Laurie. Back to you.
Excellent. Thank you for a sophisticated perspective on the problems associated with implementation, both in general and in the South Sudan case. Manav has emphasized the role of the mediator during implementation, so it's fitting that we are able to hand over now to SRSG. I've had the opportunity to observe Hannah as a mediator, albeit in a simulation exercise, and she was a tremendously successful mediator, very empathetic, solid, firm, who was able to guide the parties in this difficult simulation to a relatively successful conclusion. As I explained earlier, Hannah has internet connection difficulties in Accra, so we're going to be able to listen to her, but not see her perform visually. So Hannah, over to you.
Thank you very much, Laurie, and thank you very much to all the other panelists for their valuable contributions, which I think have summarized the situation that currently pertains in South Sudan very well, and also goes into the reasons why we have some of these challenges. And so I'd like to give a perspective on perhaps re-emphasizing some of the points that have been made already on what is left to be done, but also the areas where I think that if there were a bit more attention, perhaps we could move this process along faster. Now, I think there's a general consensus that the progress on the implementation of the transition agreement is too slow. And if things continue at this rate, the transition actions will not be completed by the end of the transition period. And that in and of itself then becomes a factor that risks further instability at some point. My colleague, David Shearer, who is the SRSG and head of UNMISS, emphasized this point recently in a press conference, where he also noted that the transition and the implementation of the transition is moving at a pace which, because there doesn't seem to be the same kind of momentum and impetus towards getting things done, the slowness of movement in and of itself can be a risk to the process. During the mediation process, now wearing my previous hat, one of the biggest disagreements we had was on the security sector reform, because there was a vast difference of opinion between what SPLM in government in Tigonu, SPLM-IO, and the other opposition elements thought should be the main features of the security sector reform. And as mentioned previously by one of the participants, they wanted to have a unified forces without necessarily going through that process of integration. But we've seen in previous peace processes in Mozambique, in Angola, as was mentioned by your colleague, that the security sector reform is an integral part of ensuring that you don't slip back into conflict. And therefore, the pace at which it has been undertaken and the lack of resources and the lack of commitment towards that process, again, is one of those risk factors that can impact overall the implementation of the agreement. So I think that it is worth continuing to emphasize to all the parties that yes, a transitional government has been formed. Yes, you have a president, you have several vice presidents, you have cabinet positions, you've now been able to agree on the states, but a government was formed to govern. And in this case, to implement a transitional agreement over a fixed period of time. And so now that those things have been done, the focus has to be on implementation. And while there are other appointments that are still pending, things can be done simultaneously. They don't need to be done one after the other. You have a situation where the transition in South Sudan has been largely an elite process, and an elite that does not trust each other. And so therefore, finding the space to build the trust between the parties in government is key towards the implementation of the transition. But I think that another way that we can also promote, if you like, greater trust, not just by the parties in government, but ultimately between the parties in government and the people in South Sudan who they are supposed to be governing for, is to have a much more transparent and accountable government. And therefore, the emphasis has to be on greater transparency in public financial management, emphasizing the need for effective public sector institutions, for more transparent public finances, for financial accountability, for greater inclusivity in the process of governance, not just among the parties who have negotiated the agreement and who are in government, but including civil society. There was a reason why we said, and we emphasized, even in the revitalized agreement, that there should be greater participation of civil society, women, and the youth. Because the point was made to all the parties a number of times, that at the end of the day, those who have the privilege of leadership lead people. They are expected to work on their behalf. And those people also have to have the opportunity to make their inputs. Now, we've created a structure called RJMEC, which was supposed to monitor the implementation of the agreement. So that creates the platform that enables both civil society and the parties to the conflict and other South Sudanese to be able to discuss how they are going to build their future. But I think that unless we are able to deal with the issues of public sector finances, greater transparency and accountability, completion of the security sector reform, the establishment of a new transitional legislature, and working towards ensuring inclusivity is not just something that is used as a popular phrase, but is actually at the core of whatever is done in ensuring that this agreement is implemented as was envisaged during the discussions. I think that unfortunately we might find ourselves in a couple of years' time saying that, well, we've been lucky, maybe we've continued to have some degree of peace and not an outbreak of large-scale conflict, but we're still not quite near to being able to move from a transitional government to a substantive government. And I think it would be very unfortunate if that is where we were. And those are my remarks, Laurie.
Hannah, thank you. It's always such a pleasure to listen to the clarity and wisdom, the insights when you do these presentations. I want to thank members of the audience, all our panelists, for fantastic contributions in capturing the complexities of peacemaking and peace building in South Sudan. So with that, I thank you all very much for your participation in this webinar, and I look forward to seeing you when we do this again in the future.
That was Larry Nathan, director of the CROC Mediation Program, ending that webinar on State of Peace in South Sudan and the implementation of the 2018 peace agreement that was held in Washington yesterday. We've come to the end of Nationwide Today. Thank you for listening. Up next is the news in English. I will be back in the next hour with details on our top stories for today.